And our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign continues. And joining me today, we've got Dr. Renee Bird. Thanks for being able to talk with me.
Great. Thanks so much for having me, Cliff.
Absolutely. So I get a little bit of background on you.
Okay.
Who's Dr. Renee Bird?
That's always the question, isn't it? All right. Who am I? So I guess I wear a lot of different hats, and I like it that way. But right now I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Sociology at Humboldt State. Most of my work revolves around prisons and policing and state violence more generally. I'm really interested in the relationship between systems of inequality, race, class, gender, and how that relates to state violence. I guess I really consider myself a scholar activist, right? So part of the impetus behind my scholarship is really building a different world. I think most of us are aware at this point that our world is pretty wounded in some ways. And so I'm interested in thinking about both a critique of what's going on, but then also thinking about more generative things around how do we heal? How do we move forward? How do we build something else? So that's who I am.
Okay. Well, great. And we have not actually talked at all about prisons or any of that and violence there. And there's a lot of just institutionalized violence as part of the whole system.
Mm-hmm.
Since you are a scholar on that, explain what you've found.
Mm-hmm. I'm really passionate about changing the system of mass incarceration that we have in this country, because I think that, you know, prisons are all over the place in our media and on television, and I think sometimes we think we know what happens in them, but in some ways they're very, very invisible too, right? They're often cited in rural areas far from people's families, and so there's a way in which they're very visible, but they're also very invisible, right? You know, part of what I'm really interested in is the way that we've had this great transformation in this country. In the early 1980s, we incarcerated about 300,000 people in our prisons and jails. And that has just ballooned. We now have about 2.3 million people in
Wow.
prisons and jails. Yeah, huge rise in that. And yet that happened without a whole lot of public discussion, right? I think seems like the way it is to people. And I'm really interested in unpacking that. How is it that happened without us seeing something profoundly wrong?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, has there been that much of an increase in crime, or are we just putting more people away?
No, we're just putting more people away. And really, even if you look back to like 1982, when Ronald Reagan announced the war on drugs, at that moment, crime was already declining, right? And so a lot of times people want to say, well, it's working, right? We've locked up all these people and now crime is down. But crime was actually decreasing before we really started incarcerating people in quite the numbers we have now, right? But we have a kind of perception that crime has increased, right? So certainly fear of crime has increased. You have a lot of discourses from the 1990s about, you know, violent young people coming to, I don't know, to get nice families or something. And so there's a lot more, I think, hype in the media about crime because it sells, right? But we actually don't have that much more crime across the board. And some types of crime have decreased. So I think that prisons haven't been a solution.
Now, the other thing is that I think statistics bear out that there are far more people being put away who are of color than the population would warrant.
Definitely. You have, you know, what we talk about is racial disparities at every turn in the criminal justice system. So, you know, if we think just specifically about drug crimes, most studies that we have show that across the population, people use and sell drugs at about similar rates across racialized groups, right? But then you see disproportionate kind of impact on people of color at every stage of the criminal justice system. So when we look at who gets, you know, stopped in their car and who has their car searched, right, disproportionately people of color are being stopped. When stopped, people of color are more likely to be searched, are more likely to then be arrested, and even upon being arrested are more likely to be charged with more serious offenses, even for the same kinds of crimes. And so, you know, all across the board, there's disproportionate impacts. People of color are more likely to be convicted and then more likely to get a harsher sentence. And so across the board, we see racial disparities in the system, definitely.
So are there any solutions that anyone's come up with at this point?
Yes. So solutions are a really interesting question. And solutions are something that I'm very interested in my work right now because I think we're at a really important moment where I think change in the criminal justice system is something that more and more people are looking for. You know, 10 years ago, or I guess I have to start saying like 15 or 20 years ago, but when I told people that I was a prison abolitionist, people thought I was kind of crazy, right? And now more and more people don't seem to think I'm that crazy anymore, which is almost kind of disconcerting. But the idea that our criminal justice system is profoundly racist is more and more commonplace. And so this is a moment, I think, of great hope in terms of change. But I also think it's a moment of incredible danger, too, because there are solutions on the table. But I think that sometimes there's this temptation to just find a quick Band-Aid solution. And I think that if we do that, we're going to end up kind of back in the same boat we've been in, right? Michelle Alexander talks about mass incarceration as the new Jim Crow, right? And something that I'm really interested in is kind of cautioning us to be very careful that we examine how we got to this point with mass incarceration, instead of just putting a Band-Aid on it and then wondering, you know, in 50 years, what will the new Jim Crow be, right? And so I think we really have to unpack the, logics of privilege and oppression that are at the root of how we ended up incarcerating so many people of color, if we're really going to truly transform these systems. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
So I think we're on the heels of change. At the same time, I think we have to be very, very careful to not to think about what genuine change and transformation look like, you know?
And there, this year in particular, there seemed to be a lot of very high-profile incidents that involve the police mm-hmm. and someone of color and dying in custody. Mm-hmm. It's so much so that it's really come to a lot of people's attention.
Mm-hmm.
Is this something that you think is new, or is this just starting to come to light?
I think that it's just starting to come to light. You know, I've talked with a lot of people over the last year or two about many of the more highly publicized deaths that have happened. And the really sad, hard reality is that this has been happening for a very, very long time, right? And I think that some of the time for people it feels really new because it's getting media coverage in a way that it never had before. You know, really problematic police shootings, people dying in jails and prisons is something that's been happening for a really long time. You know, when I used to work with an organization called Justice Now in Oakland, I was really appalled by some of the things that I saw happening to people dying inside. People have been dying inside prisons and jails for a very long time, and sometimes dying because they have been neglected or because they've been beaten, or I mean, there's some really egregious things happening in our system. And so I think that in some ways the cases that have received media attention over the last year or two have been very egregious, but they've actually been not the exception but more the rule in a lot of ways. I mean, and sometimes maybe people aren't always, you know, dying every day, but there are people being assaulted every day or experiencing other kinds of violence that really impacts you know, low-income communities, communities of color, marginalized populations. And so what I think is really amazing is that it's finally getting, you know, some media coverage in a very, very new way. And I think the Black Lives Matter movement is really to credit for that.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the Black Lives Matter movement, because I've been hoping to talk with someone with regard to that. There is not any solid organization that I can contact. Mm-hmm. But if you can speak on behalf of that, that would be fantastic.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if I'll presume to speak on behalf of it completely and represent it, but I you know, am in conversation with many people involved mm-hmm. and am deeply passionate about the movement and consider myself a part of it. So the, you know, the wonderful thing about the Black Lives Matter movement, I think, is that it, Yeah, it isn't just one organization necessarily. I think that there is actually, like, I mean, there are collections of Black Lives Matter organizations in different cities, but it's also, you know, not a kind of hierarchical, centralized kind of organization.
Right.
And that's really great. It's really very grassroots. But it really came out of, you know, it really started in some ways as a hashtag, okay? And I've never been a huge proponent of Twitter. But and this is a case, another case, where Twitter has really made a real difference, right? Of course, it's more than a hashtag now, but Black feminists, Alicia Garza, Opal Tometi, and Patrice Couleurs, you know, started the Black Lives Matter hashtag on Twitter after the death of Trayvon Martin. And, you know, that was really, I think, a moment for a lot of people.
It was
where,
shocking for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's also about the kind of accumulation of these deaths where, you know, there had been others, but there's just one too many, right? And too many Black children dying. And so that kind of sprouted in this hashtag, but then it became, of course, a much more widespread movement with the death of Mike Brown in Ferguson. And I think that once there was some media coverage around those early deaths, the more there were, the more the media paid attention. And so I think it seems really shocking that there's been all of these deaths, but really it's just that suddenly
it's coming to the forefront.
Yeah, and people are paying attention in a way that they weren't before. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a kind of thing that I think a lot of people are just kind of taken aback by it. I mean, this, mm-hmm. if you look, you know, if you go back to, say, you know, the LA riot with the Rodney King mm-hmm. incident, that was a very visual, we saw video evidence of this mm-hmm. happening, and it seemed very unjust to a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And of course, LA erupted mm-hmm. in riot after the acquittals came down. With this more and more happening, I mean, the thing is everyone now has a camera mm-hmm. in their pocket. It's called a cell phone. Mm-hmm. And more and more stuff is being exposed mm-hmm. than ever before. I mean, before it was like, you know, I'm being oppressed.
Yeah.
Your word against the cops.
Mm-hmm.
Your word against someone else.
Well, and it used to be that one hoped that with the with all these new technologies, right? Now you can take a video with your phone. I think the really difficult part is that it hasn't necessarily changed a whole lot. Mm-hmm. And that's really surprising. I mean, it makes a difference, but sometimes I'm shocked by how little difference it seems to make, right? I remember, this is hard to talk about. I remember watching the Eric Garner video, right, of him. You know, he's the man that was killed by an NYPD officer in New York who was choked. And in the video, you know, he's saying, I can't breathe, I can't breathe, you know. And when I watch that, for me, I see someone that looks like my father, right? And I'm like, you're killing him, right? But there are people, I know people who watched it and said, well, I don't know. You know, he was pretty big. And so I think even our capacity to watch some of the videos and still not see is pretty profound. And I think speaks volumes about the degree to which Black lives are treated as if they don't matter some of the time, right? Or that people, I don't know, that Black death seems natural to them. Like this is just the way it is.
Well, I mean, unfortunately, as you're pointing out, it is kind of commonplace.
Mm-hmm.
So looking, you know, being trying to be solution oriented, mm-hmm. How do we move past this as a society? How do we, I don't think any of our listeners want to just accept that this is how it is.
Yeah. Well, I think that there are a lot of different fronts that we have to fight on. Something that I'm really excited about is the work that there are a lot of feminists of color doing really amazing work on what's called community accountability. Some groups are also doing similar work under the kind of label of transformative justice. And so what those groups and individuals are doing is trying to think about ways to address violence and other kinds of harm in our communities that don't rely on policing and prisons, that don't rely on the state, right? So I don't have a hopeful message necessarily about the state because I think that there is a certain violence that is fundamental to the state. But I think there are a lot of different ways that we could organize ourselves as human beings, you know. In some ways, the modern kind of nation state is a very young invention, right? And I think there are a lot of different ways that we could organize our society and our communities to take care of each other, right? And think about, okay, what do we need? We need food. We know what we need. We need shelter. We need, you know, our children to, you know, be safe, or at least to, you know, like that to be a value. And so I think that it's about really it's about big system change, but in some ways that change is about the kind of small, intimate things in our lives, right? About what you do when your neighbor's in trouble, or when, you know, right? Like, how do we think about rebuilding communities and communities that are strong enough then to actually take care of each other? Do you know what I mean? So that sounds a bit like hopeful and like, you know, like, what is that, right? But I think that sometimes it's a really small practical thing, right? That sometimes, you know, I teach here at HSU at Humboldt State University, and you know, sometimes my students don't have anywhere to live, right? Sometimes they literally, and they're sleeping like in a building, right? You know, what if when we see that, we stopped and talked to them, you know? And sometimes as an individual, there's not a whole lot you can do. You're like, I can take you home, which is totally sometimes not a good idea, or what, right? Or I can like try to hook you up with a homeless shelter. But I think that if we ask, okay, what can we do together and start really organizing ourselves, that we can come up with a lot of new solutions. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
So we have to move beyond just individual solutions about, like, you know, what can I buy to make this go away? But, like, also, you know, think about coming together and really changing our whole view of what it means to be people in relation to a community and to each other, right? And we need each other fundamentally. We're interdependent. And so how do we build a society that recognizes that for real and doesn't, you know, we tend to imagine ourselves as these rogue individuals that don't need anyone, and the reality is that we don't live in that. That's not who we are at all. And so how do we build a world that's really cognizant of that?
So we looked a lot at things that have happened that have been very high profile nationwide, and you were talking about, you know, acting, you know, mm-hmm. locally and what we can do here. There was a very disturbing act of violence that took place last weekend, mm-hmm. That was written about. These two black women who go to school here at HSU, mm-hmm. I guess, were accosted by two white men in a pickup truck. Their mm-hmm. bottles were thrown at them. They were chased. Mm-hmm. Words were said. Fortunately, yeah. they were able to escape. But that was right here in our own backyard. Mm-hmm. Kind of scary.
Yeah. I think sometimes we tend to think, oh, well, this stuff is out there, right? And I think that that's the other thing is really, you know, when I say bringing this into kind of the intimacy of our own lives, it's really, you know, doing the hard work of seeing how it really is here, right here and right now. And I think that that's much harder. You know, I'll be honest, I heard about the incident that happened to these two young women, and I wasn't surprised, right? There's a lot of, I think, hostility toward people of color in Humboldt County. As a woman of color living here, I certainly don't always feel very safe. You know, and I think particularly for young people that, you know, I don't mean to say like I'm old, but, you know, I tend to go to bed early and I tend to like go back to my house after work, and like I don't necessarily need to go out as much as they do. But like, you know, for a college student, right, being able to walk in Arcata is really important and feel safe. And often a lot of people of color here don't, right, because I don't know. I think there's a lot of anger, to be honest with you. I find that it kind of comes together sometimes with class politics, that you know, there's some kind of anger, I think, sometimes about, you know, I don't know, people of color being able to live, is what I'm going to say, right? Able to grow, buy groceries in the grocery store, like even really mundane things like that, sometimes racism comes out. And so I think we really have to interrogate what's going on inside of us, that like we are all an incredibly white supremacist society, that like this is not an issue of a few bad individuals. This is really like steeped in our cultural politics. And so unearthing that is going to require a lot of really hard work, and we have to be willing to do it.
No, I really appreciate you mentioning that, the thing is, you know, when we think of Humboldt County, you think of a very progressive, liberal community. And
in many ways, it really is, you know.
But when something like this happens, you know, it just brings out that, you know, this is everywhere. This is pervasive. This is happening in Humboldt County, you know, it's happening everywhere. And you know, I was talking with Dr. Schnur the other day, and you know, he was saying, yeah, this is a very, you know, very loud public thing that got a lot of notice. But it is almost to the exception as far as racism goes. You know, there's a lot more racism that goes on every day. That's a lot more subtle that people have to deal with.
And the subtle stuff really adds up. You know, I mean, I think I really started to realize that more and more the older I get, that things that I was able to brush off at 18 or 19, you know, it starts to build up over years.
It's not okay.
Yeah, and it really starts to wear on you. And so, you know, thinking about, I think it's very, very important for people of color to be thinking about, you know, how do we think about healing for ourselves and creating environments that are more nourishing for us. And that's not easy. That's not easy in this world. But I think we really have to be open to constantly, you know, all of us have to be really open to constantly kind of questioning what's going on around us. That the moment that, you know, I always tell my students this, that the moment that we think we're sure that we're good people, I'm always like, oh, that's the moment where we're in the most danger. You know, and I think sometimes we're very understandably invested in imagining ourselves as good people. And I, you know, maybe it's, I don't know, I'm a strange Foucauldian scholar, but, you know, I think that's really dangerous. And I, you know, of course we want to strive to live ethical lives, but I think that we need to see that as a process, and a process that involves always questioning, right? The moment, I think being sure is deeply problematic. We need to really be open to the fact that we're complicated, you know? We're not just good or bad. We're really, really complicated. And so if we can let go of some of our investment in being pure, good people all the time, maybe we can actually get into the messy stuff and clean some stuff up, you know?
And be good people more often.
Yeah, in practice.
In practice.
Versus just our ideas about who we are, you know? I don't know.
No, that's absolutely true. I mean, there are people who, you know, talk about, you know, who put out an ideal of one thing, but act in another. And that's being in conflict with who you really are.
And human beings are not coherent. I mean, we're not neat like that. I wish we were, right? But I guess for me, in terms of thinking about political struggle, the reality of it is that it's messy, right? And that's why I really like to think about politics as much more of a kind of process versus like this identity I put on, right? Like, I don't have a t-shirt that says prison abolitionist, because in the end, like, that is not something I can measure. That's not something that maybe we can even measure right now, right? And so I have to think moment after moment about, well, what's the abolitionist thing to do right now? What's the feminist thing to do in this moment? What? And there's not one answer, right? We have to keep asking the question. That's the kind of – that's the heart of political struggle. And so I think that when we start to be sure of who we are in that way, and we're like, well, I have my feminist t-shirt, or I have my anti-racist t-shirt, so I'm anti-racist. You know, that's really a problem. It's not an identity to put on. I mean, I think it's important to like identify with that kind of cause and that struggle, but we shouldn't be sure we're always achieving it, right? Because what it looks like in practice to be anti-racist or to be feminist or whatever we're trying to think about, that changes with the context, right? There will be moments where what is needed is different than in another context, and we need to be able to really think with some complexity about that. We're complex. We're not so simple that you can just put on that hat and be like, look, it's my feminist hat. I'm sure I'm one. You know, if it were that easy, we would have done away with many of these problems by now.
Yeah, I think people need to practice their convictions.
Yeah, and it is. I mean, in practice is a wonderful concept, right, to think about what it means to build a practice in your life, whether that's like a spiritual practice or political. I mean, the whole notion of practice, I think, is really rich, and is exactly maybe what we need to be thinking about right now. I mean, theory is very, very important. I would never say it's not. But, you know, yeah, what does it mean to really walk a different kind of path than the one that's been laid out for us in this world? That's not easy.
Yeah.
Because we've been handed a path that – am I allowed to swear? I mean, no, but I mean, we've been handed some choices that aren't very good. And if we're going to imagine some new ones, we're going to have to kind of think outside the box. And that's not going to happen in one day. We have to, you know, find it by walking it.
Walking it, practicing it.
Yeah.
Not just thinking about it, not just wearing the T-shirt,
yeah.
Not just saying you are this, doing yeah. that.
And not just practicing and then saying, oh, look, that is feminist.
Done.
Or that is
– check that off
look,
the list.
That's anti-racist. You know, that we have to really ask, why? You know, why is that the thing to do right now?
Excellent. We're just about out of time, but any closing thoughts you would like to say before we wrap this up?
That is a great question. I guess I would want to close with my tale of caution about easy solutions, that I think that we need solutions right now. We need to, start walking. But I think we need to think really hard about what it means to transform and to heal on a really deep level. And to maybe sit in the messiness for a while so we really, you know, every generation has thought we've done away with racism. And I think that we need to really sit with the depth of some of the things we're struggling with so we can be imaginative and courageous in the solutions we come up with.
Excellent. Excellent. Dr. Renee Bird, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me, Cliff.
Of course. And our we're almost at the end of our 20th Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign. Tomorrow we wrap it up with our Healing Breakfast, which is going to be free and open to the public. It's also broadcast live over the airwaves of KHUM. It starts at 8, goes until 10. It's at the Women's Club in Eureka on J Street. There's going to be music from the True Gospel Singers. There'll be pastries from Ramones. There'll be delicious coffee from Signature Coffee. There'll be a room full of resource tables for you to check out. We'll have a wonderful panel of guests and a keynote speech from Betty Chin. That is right. That is all going to be coming up tomorrow, starting at 8 o'clock. And hopefully we will see you there at the Eureka Women's Club for our Healing Breakfast. It's our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign on KHUM.